T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show that focuses on people and organizations making a big difference in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan, and this is a special edition because this is Mental Wellness Month. Although May was Mental Wellness Month, July is also very, very special, and the National Suicide Prevention Hotline number was also activated this weekend. And right now, we're going to visit with my good friend, Fonda Bryant. She is a mental health awareness specialist. In fact, you are a suicide prevention specialist. And it's good having you on the show again, Fonda. How you been?
I've been well. Thank you for having me, Chris. Hope you've been doing well.
I've been doing very, very well. It's been kind of a tough situation around here because we lost a member of our Odyssey family, our engineer, Ted Nichols Payne. He passed away. It wasn't a mental situation or mental wellness or suicide. It was just, it was just one of those things, a medical situation. But again, you've been in this business, in this game long enough to know that when people are sad, you know how to console. So that's why I'm kind of glad we're talking to you, too.
Well, thank you. And I'm so sorry for y'all guys' loss. It really is true. No day is promised to us. You really have to live life to its fullest every day. You really do.
And that's why on a suicide situation, it can be prevented. You know, when someone loses their life naturally or an accident, it's like a lot of grief and regret and remorse, but then you also celebrate their lives. But on a suicide, it's a little bit more complicated because everyone in the family or the friends are like, what could I have done, right?
Yes. That's the biggest thing I always tell people as an advocate and as a survivor myself. I always tell people you have two choices. You can either help us, and yes, we might be mad at you. We might not ever speak to you again, but we're alive not to speak to you, and eventually we'll get over it. But even if we don't, we're alive. Or you can do nothing and risk going to a funeral and living with the fact that, hey, I could have helped that person. Because suicide, unlike natural causes, murder, car death, all death hurts because you're losing somebody you care about. But at the same time, suicide leaves that different feeling after somebody died because you start questioning yourself, why didn't I know? Why didn't I pick up on the signs? Or you start realizing that some of the signs after the fact, you're like, oh my God, that's what those signs were. And it can really beat you up. So the better we do on the front end with mental health and teaching people the warning signs of suicide and talking about it, having those conversations, we can and will save lives.
What are the warning signs again for those who are not familiar?
Well, some of the warning signs that I can tell you from personal experience, my appearance changed. Believe it or not, my appearance changed because I was dealing with clinical depression, the number one disease that can cause us to die by suicide. So my appearance changed because I was extremely tired. You might have someone who just wants to sleep or someone who can't sleep, someone who eats a lot, might start eating, or someone like myself, at the time, I didn't want to eat at all. You might have someone who starts consuming drugs and alcohol that never did it before, or they're consuming a lot more. They have a fascination with death. They're online searching for ways. It could be also, you know, you're just telling someone, you kind of talking about a little bit, well, you know, pretty soon you're not going to have to worry about me. Pretty soon I'm not going to be here. You need to ask that person, are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? Also, things that we used to enjoy. You know, like maybe playing a sport, maybe going out, going to the gym. All of a sudden, we're not interested in that anymore. Those could actually be signs that somebody is in trouble, and you need to ask. Changing personality. For me, I'm very talkative, very outgoing, but towards the end, I didn't want to talk to anyone. Also, someone who might isolate themselves. And as I'm always saying, isolation is not your friend, especially when you're struggling. Because when you're by yourself, those thoughts that are coming in your head can turn into action. So those are just some of the signs that people need to pick up on that somebody might be in trouble and they might need help.
You've told us your story before, but I think it needs to be told again, because when I think it was your auntie who saved you. She actually called the police to take you away.
Yes, boy, I'm going to tell you, that every time
and you were mad, you were mad.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, I don't curse. I've never smoked, never done drugs or alcohol. But that day, February 14th, 1995, a day of love, you know, people getting flowers and candy. My aunt, after I called and told her, she asked me first when I called her, I said, you could have my shoes. She called me back. That's something else, too, giving away prized possessions. Mm. You know, and it doesn't have to be somebody coming and give you a check or money or jewelry. It can be something you know that person values, sentimental value. Like for me, I love shoes. So for me to call and tell my aunt, you could have my shoes, she knew something was wrong. So she called me back. And she asked me, she said, are you going to kill yourself? And I said, yes. And she went into action like a superhero. And this is something I pick up on a lot of times with people. People always say, you know, if somebody's going to take their own life, there's nothing you can do to stop it. Yes, there is. It's in the degree that you're willing to do to stop a suicide. Because you have people like, oh, you know, I've had people who've called me. Instead of calling 911 and asking for a CIT officer, crisis intervention team officer, or putting them in the car and taking them to a mental health facility, or having them involuntarily committed, they would, you know, when you tell them that, all of a sudden, well, you know, I don't want them to lose their job, or I don't want them mad at me. Well, guess what? I guess you're ready to go to a funeral. And see, that's where I tell people all the time, there's always something you can do to stop someone from taking their life. It just depends on what you're willing to do and if you're willing for that person to be mad at you. And that's what my Aunt Kelly did. And that's what makes her such a hero. She didn't worry about her sister, who was my mother. She didn't worry about her mother that was my grandmother. And she didn't worry about how I was going to, you know, how upset I was going to be with having me involuntarily committed. But if she hadn't have done that, I wouldn't be here. So I tell everybody, again, you got two choices. You can help us, and yeah, we might be mad at you, but we're alive.
Yeah.
Or you can do nothing, and you can go to a funeral. And I'm going to tell you, when you lose somebody to suicide, and you know you could have helped them, it can eat you alive. It can eat you alive.
Yes, ma'am. Now, in your line of I don't even call it work, in your advocacy, because you are a suicide prevention advocate. We're talking with Fonda Bryant again, and Fonda's been a regular guest on this program. You have to console a lot of people. What are some of the things that you say, and is it different depending upon the person that they lost or how they are grieving? Because I know I give you special credit for this, because not everybody can console. Some people just, because people grieve in different ways. And some people just do not know what to say to someone who's lost someone, especially through suicide.
Well, the thing is, I always tell people just to let that person know that you care. Mm-hmm. Let that person know that you're there, because it really, you know, like I told you, death is death. So you don't have to try to strain and far reach for something to say around the suicide death. You can just let that person know, I care about you. if there's anything I can do, I'm here to help you. And also, one of the best things that any of us can do when somebody dies, and especially by suicide, is just listen. Be willing to just listen and let that person dump.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
get things off their mind. Yeah,
get their things off their mind. You know, and also have resources available. Talk to them about, hey, you might want to, if, like I tell everybody all the time about the EAP, Employee Assistance Program, through their job, where it helps with grief, finances, marital issues, and mental health. And you can see a grief counselor. Go and talk to a professional and get help. It's no shame in that. But if you're going to reach out to someone, make sure, like I said, number one, you're willing to listen. Let them know, hey, I care. And if they're not willing to talk or want to open up at that time, you open the door by saying, hey, I know this is hard for you right now. Whenever you're willing to talk, I'm here. That means a lot, because in that moment, we're still people might still be trying to process and understand. And then when you throw how culture is in mental health and suicide, because, again, not everybody's going to be understanding and have empathy and compassion for someone who dies by suicide, especially in culture.
Oh, yes.
Because especially
right,
in culture.
It's you, when you say in culture, you're talking about people who are black and brown in this country, because growing up in the church, it's like that's you just don't do that. You don't go there. You don't think about that.
Mm-mm.
You don't do that. That's not God's plan necessarily.
No. So you got to take in mind, you know, just let that person know you care. But as I said, you're going to have people, when people die by suicide, that look at it as, oh, they're just weak. They're just selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's that big other S that goes with stigma, is shame.
Yeah, the shame. And there are people who have someone who've died from suicide in their family, and the family feels shame as opposed to tears. It's like, wait a minute, why do you feel this way? Well, like you said, it was the way they were raised.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I lost my extended son. It'll be a year on August 19th to suicide. He was on the championship football team at Wake Forest. He graduated a year behind. My son went into law enforcement, was a special investigator for DeKalb County District Attorney. My son was the best man at his wedding. And when Pierre died, it's amazing how you get to see almost two sides in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
The mother of his child that lives here in North Carolina, she put up there on her Facebook, you know, people need to get help. You know, don't be ashamed if you're struggling. You know, she talked about his suicide. On the flip side, the wife didn't want anybody to know. And when I posted something about him dying by suicide and that if you're struggling to go get help, oh, she reached out to me, take it down. Take it down. And I said, you know something, this is part of the problem. And I had empathy and compassion for her. Don't get me wrong. But part of the problem is when somebody dies by suicide, it should always be a teachable moment.
Right.
Because it's other people sitting out there who are going through struggling and they don't want to say anything. So when people die by suicide, again, you had the same empathy and compassion for them if somebody was killed in a car wreck, if somebody was murdered. Because when he died by suicide, I let people know the way he died had nothing to do with the way he lived, the kind of person he was. He was a good man. And suicide doesn't change that.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that you're a weaker person. It was just a mental struggle that they were going through.
Yes. And see, in law enforcement, that's what I keep telling people. I have a lot of friends of mine that are police officers. What they see is not normal, and what they do is not normal.
Yes.
We lost last year, and mind you, anytime I give you suicide stats, they're underreported. We lost 156 police officers across the country last year to suicide, and already in July, last week, I got the suicide stats. 2 days apart, the first stat said we had lost 65 officers to suicide. 3 days later, 68. So we have got to quit setting up, slapping that. You're weak, you're selfish, you're crazy on it, because suicide affects any and everyone, and it does not care, just like mental health in itself. If you don't take care of your mental health, your mental wellness, it can take you down that path to suicide real quick.
Fonda, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, number has been activated as of this weekend. That number is 988. Instead of 911, it's 988. Can you give us some information on that? And here locally, I understand that Dak Prescott has done some things and lended his name and support because for Cowboy fans, they know that he lost his brother to suicide a couple of years ago.
Yes. And I think about him, too. And again, it just really shows that, you know, suicide doesn't care who we are or who we're connected with. So 988 came about because they wanted to shorten where people can remember a number when they're in crisis, because the 800-273-8255, it really got elevated when Logic came out with that song, and
right.
I think it really helped people to memorize that number. But we wanted a shorter version so people can remember it quick to get help. Now here, I know I'm an advocate, and I know I'm a suicide survivor, and I'm a little bit torn between 988, and this is why. First off, I want everybody to know 800-273-8255 is not going anywhere. You will still be able to use that. 988 has been delegated to each state. Each state is going to be responsible for those calls coming in from 988. But this is going to be a little bit tricky for right now. Let's say you moved here from Dallas, Texas, and your area code is 214. So you would call 988 thinking, hey, I'm going to get help in North Carolina now because I live in North Carolina. That's not how it goes for right now. If you call and your phone number, area code is 214, mm-hmm. it's going to route you to Texas.
Oh.
Even though you're living in North Carolina.
And that's an issue because people take their cell phones wherever they go and they don't change their phone number.
They may move to California
and they still have a 212 from New York.
Exactly. So that's going to be a problem because every second counts. And they should have kind of worked that out before they decided to switch. And this is something else, too, I want everybody to know. Young people, we can't even get them to talk on the phone, even when they're in crisis.
That's right.
I read a report that said that when youth are in crisis, young people, only 5% call the National Suicide Hotline. The rest text home to 741-741. That text number is just as important as that 988 because a lot, you think about it, when you're in crisis and you're an adult, it's hard to sometimes to even call a total stranger and explain what is going on. But when you're dealing with a
suicide
youth,
yeah.
When you're dealing with youth suicide, they tend to want to call. I mean, text.
Text. That's what they do.
They want to text.
It's so funny you bring that up. Let me throw in this real quick, and you can continue on. People have got to understand the way people communicate nowadays is really broken down by age groups, because I think a lot of kids under the age of 25, they, first of all, they're not going to answer any voicemail. They're not going to leave a voicemail. And they rarely like to call. They like to text each other. It's just like, you know, a lot of adults will be on Facebook. A lot of them be on Twitter. There's so many kids that they would never go on Facebook. They're on Snapchat or they're on TikTok or wherever else. They're Instagram, but they're not. You gotta be able to reach people where they are in their information bubble. And with kids under the age of 25, it is texting.
Yes, it's texting.
And what's that number again, the text number?
The text number, they can text one word, HOPE, HELP, TALK, HOME, one word, to 741-741, and they're going to hit them right back. They're going to hit them right back.
Mm-hmm.
So that text number, as a matter of fact, the wristband that I wear every day, the text number is on the outside of the wristband, and the National Suicide Hotline number is on the inside, because I know being around high school students, college athletes, that they're going to text rather than call.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So I'm glad we do have a quicker number, but at the same time, I still think it's going to be people that are still going to use that text, and I would love to see the response that that text number has gotten. Because I pretty much think it might be the same, or it might even be higher than the National Suicide Hotline. Because mm-hmm. sometimes when you're in crisis, it's very hard to open up and talk, especially for youth.
Could you talk about the numbers again of those who have attempted suicide and those who actually committed suicide? Because I think you showed some numbers earlier, if not this show, a previous show, that there's a lot of young people that are attempting to lose their lives.
Yes, unfortunately. Well, the stats say, first off, in 2020, when everybody, during the pandemic, and we were all at home, a lot of people thought that the suicide rates were going to be through the roof. And actually, they dropped 3%, but one is one too many. So for black people, people of color, and young people 15 to 24, suicide is up. Also, young people 10 to 34, that is the second leading cause of death in the United States. The 10 to 34, that's the second leading cause of death for young people, is suicide. Also, for black males right now have the highest rate of suicide among any ethnic group.
Wow.
Can you believe it?
Wow.
Black males have the highest rate. College students, you send your kids off to college, you think everything's okay. Well, it's not. Suicide is the second leading cause of death on college campuses. Over 1,400 college students die by suicide every year, and over 22,000 attempt every year. And here in the U.S. too, we're losing about 125 Americans a day. Over 17 veterans, which has dropped, over 17 veterans a day, and close to 4,000 Americans attempt every day. And again, all these stats that I'm giving you are underreported. So suicide is a whole lot worse than what I'm telling you, because what it really boils down to, Chris, suicide is not a personal character flaw. It's not a character flaw.
No.
It is a global health crisis, because we're losing 2,000 people every day worldwide to suicide, and 50,000 people attempt worldwide. Let that sink in for a minute.
That is crazy. And we're talking with Fonda Bryant. She is a mental health awareness and suicide prevention advocate. And you've gotten some national notoriety over the years, but just recently, Yahoo, Life Unmuted did a feature on you. Could you talk about how that came about? And then again, we can tell everybody how they can find the link, because I think it's worth reading. And congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. You know, the thing is, it's nice sometimes to get the accolades, but if it's going to help someone, if somebody's going to reach out to me and say, hey, I want to take the training, that's what for me it's all about. But Yahoo reached out to me because I've had two national stories on Yahoo. One, when I won the Remarkable Woman of the Year nationally, and then when I did the 20-plus mile walk to stop suicide. And they reached out to NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, where I sit on the state board for North Carolina, and they reached out to them saying, hey, we need to find her. And they were able to find me. We did an interview, and they turned it into a story. So it's really nice. Not only is it written, but it's verbal with pictures, and I just really am proud of that, because people have been reaching out to me, asking me about the training, thanking me for what I'm doing, asking me, you know, so-and-so needs help. Can you help me with resources? So that's what I really get excited about. I mean, it's hard for me, believe it or not, to get recognition, because with depression, I don't feel like I deserve it, believe it or not.
July is Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. Can you talk about that and black mental health in particular, and the different things? We've talked about the culture and how people stigmatize it, and it's like a shame. But could you talk about this month and how much it means for so many people who may be hearing this conversation?
Well, for us, you know, for people of color, we have been raised, you know, that we don't talk about mental health. It's taboo. And, you know, we came from generational trauma. Black people, you know, taken in slavery. When you see how we were treated, from physical abuse to verbal abuse, and then it was just passed on. Because for some reason, that late 60s, 70s, 80s, they feel like that they came through pretty well, but they really didn't. because it was a lot of self-medicating and other things. So this month is the B.B. Moore Campbell National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, which is a mouthful, is to bring awareness to mental health in culture, from Black people to Hispanic to Native American to Asian to Polynesian to Samoan, and to really show that our culture plays a big part in how we view mental health. And so what we try to do is that month is to bring some of the factors in that cause us to act the way that we do or the things that we've had to deal with. For instance, racism and what's going on in this country takes a big toll on our mental health. And I'll give you a perfect example. Here in Charlotte last week, we had a young white male who hijacked four cars and drove from Charlotte to South Carolina, back to Charlotte, to uptown Charlotte, until they finally caught him. Somebody rammed their personal car into the car. They took him out. He only had a sprained wrist. Now, Akron, Ohio, young man in Lewes Police gets out of car and runs, shot 60 times, wasn't it?
Yes.
60 times. Imagine for mothers who have Black males, or imagine Black males. Think about how that affects our psyche.
There's a lot of stress.
It's a lot of stress, and that plays a humongous part in our mental health, is racism. Poverty, you know, just thinking about, I'm not ever going to get out of this situation because things right now are so high, and so everything is so uncertain now. You know, I put up on my Facebook page not too long ago, I said, we truly are living in critical times, hard to deal with. We really are. So you play all of that into our culture. And then on top of that, let's throw the religious factor in. Have we been, everything start in the, especially in the Black culture, everything starts at the church. Somebody brought that to my attention the other day. Political, everything in our culture starts at the church, including mental health, because how were we raised with that? Just pray. Just give it to God. Or we were taught mental health was a demon, especially if you had a psychosis, mental health disorder, like bipolar or schizophrenia. So when you throw all of those factors in, and then you throw in that it's already not enough resources as it is for everybody, and then you throw in how we're viewed, how we look at mental health, and then even the treatment. Because sometimes that's why you have so many people of color wanting to go see a therapist or psychiatrist that looks like them. Because they feel like that a lot of white professionals in the field don't really understand their culture. And then when you don't speak English well or something like that, it's a barrier with that. So it's just a lot to take into account. And that's why NAMI and Mental Health America do such a great job breaking it all down to educate people and to help people of color and Black people to understand that even though we do have hurdles and the way we've been raised, we can still get help and get better. And there's no shame in doing that.
Exactly. You know, one of the reasons why I like having you on as a guest is because you make the topics that we're talking about very relatable. People can see themselves in different aspects of what you're talking about, or family members or neighbors or friends, and they can relate. And on that one level right there, I mean, one of the ironies I thought about was, you know, summertime and baseball and the All-Star weekend is here, and baseball Midsummer Classic is right around the corner. And everybody knows the legend of Jackie Robinson and how Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. And his number, 42, is retired. It's the only number that's retired in every major league team in the nation because of what he went through. And if you ever saw the movie 42, and I don't know if you've seen it, Fonda. Have you seen
it? I haven't got to see it.
It's a good opportunity to see it this summer, and it's a great baseball movie, but it also talks about what he had to go through. And when Branch Rickey, who was running the Dodgers, brought him over, he said, you're not the best player in the Negro Leagues, but you're the mentally toughest player that's going to be able to handle all of this. Because you could be, and by the way, he was a great athlete. He was a fantastic athlete. But not everybody, even though you're athletically gifted, can mentally handle all of the stress that someone would have to go through. So when you gave those descriptions of people of all different races, people of color, of the things that, you know, maybe a white therapist or a mental health official couldn't quite understand. Just think about Jackie Robinson. Just think about just the mental toughness that you have to have just to kind of relax and do what you normally do.
Yes, you're right. But I'm going to tell you something about Jackie Robinson or any of those people who broke color barriers or had to deal with that. Can you imagine the anxiety that he felt
exactly.
every day coming out there on that field and not having to show it?
Yes, that's what this movie does. The movie's called 42. It shows you. And it's like, oh, my God. It's one thing to hear his story. It's another thing to see it on the screen. And this is not a documentary. It's a Hollywood movie, but it's very, very much based on fact. And it's just showing you that the mental toughness that he had to go through with the fans yelling things at him, the opposing players and pitchers, his own teammates, the other managers, where he had to dress separately, stay in different hotels, all those little things, the wear and tear mentally that he had to go through, let alone he had to play well because he was because there's another thing. He's also representing. You follow me? There's a lot of people who are looking up to him saying, show him, Jackie, show him how good we can be. That'll allow us to get a chance as well. And I'm only bringing up his story because there's some comps there where people will say, wow, you know, I could understand, or maybe I need to watch that movie and maybe that will allow me to understand what maybe some current people are going through. And I'll give you another comp that you can break down even better. You were talking about veterans. Can you talk about veterans of all backgrounds, male and female, when they come back to the United States or they're back into the quote-unquote real world, they're not, you know, on the base anymore, they're not in the service anymore, and the highs and the lows that they have to deal with?
Well, you know what, veterans, it's just like police officers. What they see is not normal. What they do is not normal. And I'm not trying to get preachy, so everybody listening, don't think I'm trying to be preachy. But when you really think about it, God didn't intend us to go to war. He didn't intend us to be violent with each other. He intended us to live in peace. So with them going into combat and stuff and seeing what they have to see and killing people, some may be perceived as enemies, but sometimes people get caught up. I mean, you hear about children getting killed in the war. So you think about all of that. And just like I tell police officers, it's like your brain takes a picture of everything you see, good, bad, indifference, and it stores it in your brain. And then when you are in a quiet place or a smell, a sound can trigger all of that. Because all police officers and everyone who's been in combat or in any kind of combat, all of them have post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma. So they come back. And on the outside, like I always tell people, we look perfectly normal, whatever normal is. But on the inside, they're struggling. They're struggling. And they don't want to be perceived as weak.
Right.
As, you know, they don't want to be perceived as, hey, you can't handle it. You got to be mentally tough. You got to suck it up because that's what they're told. And then they come back. And they're having to deal with maybe lost a limb, or they can't see, or even if they didn't suffer any kind of physical, they're still dealing with mental challenges.
Sometimes they have nightmares.
They have nightmares, and it can turn to substance abuse. We have so many veterans that have ended up homeless and on the streets, and a lot of them are dealing with substance abuse. Matter of fact, last year here in Charlotte, there was this really nice guy. I had a flat tire. My car was on the side of the road. He came across the street, and we started talking. He was homeless, and we started talking. He should have been a model because he really did look like a model. And he was homeless, and he was a military veteran. He was a military veteran, and he was homeless, and he was doing drugs and alcohol. And I begged him. I said, let me help you get help. I can put you with NAMI. I can put you with services. And I think for them, sometimes they'd rather be out there on the streets because they don't have to sit up and worry about stuff or have to do stuff because they're just so they've dealt with so much trauma. They feel like it's no way back. So we have to do a better job helping these veterans with mental health, because VA hasn't always done great by them, but they got to be able to help these veterans because, again, what they see is never going to go away.
We're talking with Vonda Bryant, and Vonda, you've been advocating this QPR suicide prevention training. Can you tell everyone once again what the letters QPR stand for? And then we'll get into some of the progress you've made recently. But
okay. Well, in 2 hours, I can train anyone how to recognize the signs of someone in crisis or suicidal, talk and listen to them in a non-judgmental way, and be able to get them help. In the time that you watch a movie, you can be trained in how to save someone's life. The training is called QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer, Suicide Prevention Training. I have been a certified instructor now since 2018, and when the pandemic hit, I started training people online just thinking, hey, I'd rather do this than to just sit here. And I had no idea what it was going to turn into, you know, training thousands of people from all over, not just the United States, but from all over the country to all ages. I had a lady a couple of weeks ago back in June that took my training from England. And I was just so excited about that. I train youth here at the high school I work at, Hopewell High School. I trained 105 students in 2 days, and 75 of them were student athletes. And the best feedback that I got from a student, he came to me before school ended, and he said, Ms. Fonda, I just want to tell you that training was excellent, because not only did it help me to help other students, it helped me to gauge my own mental health. That's a win-win. You can't get any better than that when it comes to mental health and suicide. So I train online. I do one free training a month. On Saturdays, I pick a Saturday, and I train from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. Once the person takes all the training, then they get a certificate that lasts for 3 years. They are a certified gatekeeper, which means they know how to save a life. They know how to help someone. And as I always tell people, when somebody asks me in training, they said, Ms. Fonda, how do you keep from panicking yourself when you're trying to help someone? I said, learn the resources in your area. When you get finished with this training and you get your QPR booklet and your resource card, print off that resource card and write down resources in my area, like Dallas, Texas. You type in NAMI Dallas, Texas. You go to their website, go to the resource page, type in mental health resources in my area. Ask the person, do you have insurance? Ask the person you're helping, do you have an employee assistance program at your job? Because the more you know on the front end, the better you will be to help that person without panicking. And the only difference between the youth training and the adult training is we urge youth to go tell someone, because we all know that youth are set up and think that if you go tell something on somebody, that's snitching.
Right.
But I told them, I said, this is totally different. This is about somebody's life, so you have to tell. So I always ask the students that I train, because I train middle school and high school, and I ask them, I said, how many of y'all right now can save somebody's life, by, you know, save somebody's life, and they'll raise their hand. But when we get finished with the training, I ask them, I said, how many of y'all could save someone's life and go tell an adult, and all their hands go up? That training, see, I've learned something over the years from doing this training. People don't usually, they don't feel comfortable helping someone sometimes that are, that's suicidal or in crisis, because they feel like I'm going to say something or I'm going to do something
right
to make it worse.
Right.
But that's why they don't do it. But if you give them the tools, if you educate them, they become empowered and they don't have a question at all about helping someone. This training really does give you spider sense. You look at people differently. You listen more intently, because we're not all flailing our arms saying, oh, my God, I'm going to kill myself. It could be very subtle, like pretty soon I'm not going to be here, or change in appearance, like I told you, or the person's not eating. It's just in that training we go through myths and facts of suicide. For instance, if you ask a person if they're going to kill themselves, it does not increase the chance of them taking their own life. What it does do, so that's a myth, but what it does do, this fact, it lowers anxiety. It gives the person a chance to open up and talk about what's going on with them, and it gives us a chance to help them. So you learn the myths and facts. Like if we talk about suicide, people will do it. That's a myth. If we talk about suicide, we can stop it. It's just great training. And, of course, I use my own personal journey and I use examples of people that I've helped so you clearly see what this training is about and what you have to do. Because it's people that I have already trained, adults and youth, that have used that training to save somebody's life. And as I said, you can't get any better than that.
You've always said colleges need to have this. You've talked about schools need to have this, just like they have situational awareness for active shooters. I mean, this is just about saving lives. We're not talking about politics. We're just talking about saving lives of kids and teachers, right? So
yes.
At one point, when I was talking to you casually, you were saying that you had reached out, you'd sent emails to commissioners of the different schools, the different universities and schools, like the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the ACC, the Big 12, the MAC, the SWAC, the CIAA. Can you talk about some of the results you've been having and if you've heard anything back from anybody at all recently? Because I know you've been really wanting, especially with college kids, because every time you look up, you hear about a big star college athlete, they decided they didn't want to stick around anymore. They didn't want to live.
Yes, you know, because there's so much pressure on these student athletes, you know, with doing their schoolwork and then being an athlete and pleasing their parents, and they
and
fall
social
down that
media
ladder.
And social media,
you know, and they fall down that ladder. So after we lost four female student athletes in 3 months this year, I had it. And I said, you know, enough is enough. I had gone to, it was painstaking reaching out to athletic directors at the Big 12, the Pac-12, mm-hmm. the Big 12, ACC, and not one person even had, only a couple of people had, you know, responded back. So I said, you know what, I'm going to go straight to the commissioners. So I sat down, I wrote for Memorial Weekend, and I wrote the big three of the Power Five conferences. Mm-hmm. I wrote the new commissioner for the ACC, I wrote the commissioner for the Pac-12, and I wrote the commissioner for the Big Ten. And weeks went by and I didn't hear anything. I said, okay, you're going to have to start calling. So I started calling their offices and leaving voicemails. And lo and behold, I have heard back from the commissioner from the Big Ten, Kevin Warren. He personally called
Very
me.
Very nice.
And he said he wants to sit down with me and his chief medical officer to talk about ways to help not only just the student athletes in the Big Ten, but students, period. You know, because like I told him, this is something I learned from my son. Student athletes are brothers and sisters, and they look out for each other both on the field and off the field. And I told him, I said, if we give them the tools of education and training, I have no doubt that they will save one of their friends and help them out, whether it's their teammate or it's their roommate or it's somebody in their class. They will do that. So I've reached out to the MAC, SEC, CIAA, all of the conferences. I sent letters last week, and I'm going to give them to the end of this week, and then I'll start following up again, because this is just too important. And
yes.
When you have student athletes who are sitting up trying to make the NCAA more accountable for mental health and suicide, that's a problem. Because, see, in 2019, I reached out to the NCAA about QPR, making it mandatory for coaches and student athletes. And they were like, they gave me all these excuses like, well, you know, it's up to the schools. No, y'all can have training for sexual assault, all these other things. Suicide should be, mental health training and suicide prevention training should be a priority. It should be a priority.
Well,
because I've trained student athletes and I know
yes.
the training works.
It does, and again, that's why you're an advocate, because you don't give up. You really keep going as baby steps, but you continue the process along, and then there's always a breakthrough. And the breakthrough saves lives, especially when it comes to suicide prevention. Fonda, so over the next couple of weeks here, in fact, you did something this weekend too, didn't you?
Yes, I had another QPR training class, and it was a great class, and I will continue to do QPR suicide prevention training. And I urge all your listeners out there to take the training. It's 2 hours. In the time you watch a movie, you can learn how to save someone's life. The training is upbeat, it's positive, and I guarantee you, however you felt about suicide, or you felt, you know, that the person, we might be weak or we're just selfish or whatever the case may be, I guarantee you, if you take that training, it's going to open your eyes and it's going to change the way you look at suicide. It's going to change the way that you help other people, especially with your children. Because I'm at a high school where kids come to me every single day. Miss Fonda, I'm struggling. Miss Fonda, I can't talk to my parents. Miss Fonda, I'm self-medicating. Especially students that come from homes where both parents work. They got a nice home. They live in a nice area. They've told me, they said, my parents say, what do you have to be depressed about? What do you have to be sad about? Like, mental health is equated to what kind of car you drive or where you live or what kind of money you're bringing in. It has nothing to do with that. And I'm going to tell you, the suicide rates are going to continue to soar until everybody gets involved, because on the back of my T-shirt, it says, one of the T-shirts that I wore when I walked 20-plus miles, suicide is everybody's business, and anyone can prevent the tragedy of suicide.
Fonda, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. Fonda Bryant, she's an expert in QPR, suicide prevention training. She's an advocate, and of course, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you, Fonda.
Thank you for having me, and y'all take care.
She's Fonda Bryant. I'm Chris Arnold, and right now I'd like to turn the program over to our Odyssey colleague from Milwaukee's 107.3 KISS FM, Riggs, who's visiting with mental health expert Dr. Christine Modier in conjunction with the national launch of the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 988.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Welcome to an Odyssey Mental Wellness Initiative. It's I'm Listening, because talk has the power to save lives. My name is Andy Riggs, and I'm very happy to be joined today by the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Dr. Christine Moutier. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Riggs, for having me on. I'm so excited to be here.
How do you feel the overall mental health state of America is? Like, how are we? I know we've had a lot of conversations about mental health, but are we improving with our mental health, do you feel like, overall?
You know, I feel like it of course depends on who you talk to. And there are people who are struggling. Absolutely. There are also a lot of people who have found new ways to thrive and cope because of the experiences of sort of being able to dialogue about it like never before. You know, some of the experiences might have been new, or they might have been, you know, worsening of their pre-existing depression or anxiety. And I actually just had the opportunity to review the CDC's Household Pulse Survey, which has been throughout the pandemic kind of taking the pulse of mental health experiences of like average Americans, all different demographics, geography, age groups. And it looks to me like there is a sort of steady state going on overall. But again, it really depends on who you talk to. And there are families, there are young people, there are middle-aged people who are 100% struggling. And again, trying to access mental health care, sometimes connecting with that and sometimes not being able to do that. So there's a lot of things going on, for sure.
There's a lot of talk about mental health. We have celebrities speaking out. We have athletes speaking out. We have, you know, newscasters and media people speaking out. Do you think that's also helping with people to reach out for help?
Absolutely. Dialogue and disclosure about our true, authentic experiences as human beings, which includes our mental health. You know, remember, we all have mental health. Sometimes we're struggling. Some of us have mental health conditions, but we all have mental health. So talking about it, and those examples, those role models and people who are doing that I view it as having been someone who's done that myself over time. It's actually very freeing, because what happens is other people connect with you and you have a sense of like your relationships deepen. You get to be freed up and much more authentic and receive support and find new pathways. Otherwise, until that happens, there's a sort of a stuckness that can happen with our mental health.
What's a good way to get out of those ruts that a lot of us find ourselves in?
I think that is an awesome topic, because when you are struggling, your brain is not working optimally. You are not feeling your best. Oftentimes we have our own sort of self sense of stigma that keeps us sort of stuck and keeps us silent. But what I would say is, I would say to anybody who is struggling, think of one person that you view as a safe, trusted person in your life, where you at least have a sense that they're going to understand, or if not understand, just not judge. And I would start with that person. On the receiving end of things, there's some kind of lessons learned here as well. If someone in your life starts to kind of hint at stuff they're going through, they might just be in a way kind of testing you out to see if you are a person who can be supportive and trustworthy and handle a conversation where you actually show interest in wanting to learn more about what it is they're experiencing.
How should we respond on that receiving end if we are the person that someone comes to?
I would say to the person, I'm so glad you trusted me to even be able to say what you're really going through. And I want you to know there's no judgment. And I want to learn more about what it is you're experiencing. And you can just stop right there and let them tell you more. Remember, you don't have to be their clinician, their doctor, their therapist. You are whatever you are to them, their sibling, their friend, their colleague. And so your job is to respond like they had just told you. Imagine something else that it would be very private, but a matter of health. Let's say that they're going through a new diagnosis of diabetes or cancer or something very serious. You wouldn't, run away from that. You would say, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry you're going through that. How can I support you? Tell me more about what it is you're going through. I want to be a good friend to you.
Talk really does have the power to save lives. That's why we're here today. It's Odyssey's Mental Wellness Initiative. I'm listening, and I'm here with Dr. Christine Moutier, the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Can we hit really quick on the topic of asking someone about suicide? Because I think there's still a big myth out there that if you ask someone about suicide, you're going to plant the idea in their head. And that's just not true. And you knowing your research, can you talk to that point, please?
Yeah, there are several studies that actually show that that is not the case, that asking somebody if they're having thoughts of ending their life is actually a way to provide help and relief. I would say that it's important to ask the question. The way that I do it is linking up with something that the person has just told me. Usually people, if you say, I really want to understand how you're doing and what's going on in your life, they'll tell you about the circumstances of their life, right? I'm going through this thing at my workplace, my marriage, I'm struggling, finances, breakup, it'll be kind of facts about circumstances, but the way that they explain it, their tone of voice, the words that they use will give you hints about whether they might be feeling like that they feel overwhelmed, maybe that they feel that they're a burden to others, like they might feel that they're trapped. All of those words or tone of voice are my entry to think, oh my goodness, this person may be struggling to the point that they might be having thoughts of suicide. And the way I ask the question is I say, when you say, and I literally repeat their phrase that they've just used, it makes me wonder if you're having thoughts of ending your life. And you can just leave it right there. And I think asking it very directly like that is the best way to show that, number one, you can handle it. And number two, that there's no judgment and that you've stopped talking. So you're ready to listen. And that's, of course, the most important part.
Let's talk about the 988 number that has just gone into place. A lot of people may not know about it, but previously we had a longer number, 1-800-273-TALK, 8255. It was just a lot. And I think for a while we kind of advocated to get a shorter number, almost a 911 for the brain. And that's what we have. What is 988? What does this mean?
988 is the new 3-digit number for any type of mental health or suicide related crisis. And that includes substance abuse crisis as well. So really anything that is impacting the way you are thinking, feeling, functioning, that may be related to stress, depression, anxiety, trauma. I mean, it is a wide open field. So, and as you pointed out, it's not just the person who's struggling that can use this 988 number. It is the people in their lives, the people who are trying to help someone they're worried about, can get a lot of guidance by calling 988. I want to make one point. 988 is like the 911 for the brain, for mental health, whereas 911 is being used for, you know, medical emergencies that are mostly physical health. The biggest difference that I think is important to realize is that 911 is a really important resource in our nation. It is a dispatch center. So it's not that the person who is having chest pain, you know, is going to get medical treatment from the 911 operator, but with 988, the call itself is with a trained professional. And so there is an intervention, there's a therapeutic experience that happens just by calling 988. In the rare instance that that call needs to lead on to other referrals and other actions, that can happen too. But in the large majority of cases, 988 is the therapeutic experience.
This is for texting as well. I'm assuming I've heard that you can text as well, and it's kind of linked with the crisis text line.
Yes, you can call or text or chat with 988 from any part of the United States.
What did your role at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention play in getting the 988 number to come to fruition this year?
I think we took a lead in the advocacy space at the national level, and then in coalition with many other important organizations as well, to really help Congress understand that mental health is critically important for our nation. It is the case that AFSP is not the organization that runs the Lifeline or 988. That is a colleague organization called Vibrant Emotional Health that does that. And a number of us in the space are able to advocate, you know, for what the nation needs. So it is a really exciting time. And again, it's not just that it's a more memorable 3-digit number, although that is important to treat mental health just like we do physical health. So 988 makes sense in light of 911, you know, for physical health emergencies. But it is also this incredible opportunity to really reimagine and transform our nation's crisis response system. I think with stigma going down, people are just more willing to get help now as well. Yeah. But again, it's that there can be new funding sources now at the state level to build that infrastructure for a more appropriate, person-centered mental health professionals in lieu of a primary law enforcement response that was built out of, you know, sort of almost by happenstance in the past. We need to move away from that. We need trained mental health clinicians to be responding to mental health crises.
Right. The 988 number, these numbers are routed locally first, I might understand. They just go to local call centers first, which whatever state you happen to be in, be it New York, California, Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois. And then those numbers then overflow if someone in your immediate state is not able to answer. How important is it to make sure that we get the funding that we need for this new 988 number?
It is essential. We see that the volume of calls have been going up over the last decade or so pre-launch of 988. So each crisis center at the county or state level is sort of funded in different ways. And we need to step it up as a nation. If we're really going to prioritize mental health, we are going to make it a priority and put the funding there that's required to hire and train the right number of staff, which by the way, peer specialists can be a part of this response as well. Although through the 988 system, they are all professionals that you will speak with. But I just want to say that people with lived experience can also be called upon and trained to be a really important part of what happens next in terms of a person's access to support and education and treatment and recovery.
Can we speak a little bit to the stigma that still exists around mental health and how someone may feel, well, if I call 988, I don't want the police to show up. I don't want to cause any trouble. I don't want to feel like I'm inconveniencing somebody, a lot like what you would think if you reached out to a friend.
Yes. So I think it is the extremely rare instance that a call to the Lifeline or 988 now would result in the police showing up. That is a rare event that is reserved for extreme situations where imminent risk to the person or others is determined to be the case. So, you know, in terms of stigma, I think one of the biggest concerns is who will find out? Where does this information go? Is it tracked? Will my employer know? Is my family going to know? And I think this is sort of a two-level issue. On the one hand, stigma is reducing, and we are aiming for a time and a world to live in where mental health is treated exactly like physical health is. So there still might be privacy concerns. We still have matters of, you know, private health. But that when it comes to receiving care and being able to get support from your community, your family members, treatment, that stigma should not be in the way of that. But I think the additional key piece, when you are the one who's struggling, your brain is playing tricks on you. You are not thinking as clearly as you do in your usual state of health. And so you are thinking, I'm weak, I'm going to get in trouble. You know, all these sort of extreme sort of, you know, always, never, my life will be over. I won't be able to work, you know, really extreme and mostly very untrue beliefs will be going through a person's mind. And so I only point that out because you may be surprised if you're thinking, I can't call 988 or I can't seek mental health care because of whatever, what my family will think, what my colleagues will think. I just want to point out that most likely your own thought process may be the biggest barrier in the way. And you'll find out by just taking that step of calling how much help and relief and support is out there. And in the vast majority of cases, there's just no negative that comes from it. It's like, if you were having chest pain or you're having some other physical health problem, when you reach out for help, that's the start of treatment, recovery, support, and healing. And it's the same thing for mental health.
And 988, the number is now live. And also the Suicide Prevention Lifeline number will still lie. It will still work. It'll still direct to that 1-800-273-TALK. So know that both of those numbers are now active and up and ready for you to use right now.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.